So yeah, so I'm an assistant professor at the University of Ottawa. I've been there for about 2.5 years now. And this is my research group. Some of these people, well, actually, they're all still my research group, except for that guy. So one of the things I like to do is try and convince people to do a graduate degree with me. So this is much like here, we have a beautiful building with stabilized labs. Mine's on the, it's actually underground. On a nice thick slab of concrete to keep it stable. Right, so basically my talk is all about trying to measure complementary variables. So this is a lot like Ephraim's talk, and a lot of the same ideas will pop up in my talk as his. So essentially the problem is the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, or the Heisenberg disturbance decision relation, depending on what you want to call it. So say we have these photons coming from left to right, and they have some spatial wave function, some transverse spatial wave function. We could measure in position, and we can measure in momentum just by putting a lens in, and we can go between position space and momentum space. And we can put a detector here and move it across, and we can measure the probability distribution. We can measure the momentum distribution. But we don't really see the state. If we try and measure the state of a classical particle, we'd measure X and P, and we'd know its state perfectly. We don't see its state because there's this phase that isn't determined by these two probability distributions. And essentially the problem is that in classical physics, we could measure X and P jointly, but in quantum physics, if you put a slit in, you're going to localize this wave function to here, it'll diffract, fill up this lens, and you'll end up with this completely uncertain momentum distribution. So you guys probably know that, especially after Ephraim's talk. So essentially the whole idea or sort of loose theme that joins the different experiments I'm going to talk to you about today is what would like a naive person who's ignorant of physics or quantum physics do to try and get around this principle? And then what happens if we actually translate those naive schemes into quantum mechanics? So say a person ignorant of the laws of physics could be somebody like that handsome guy there. And you know, you might have some silly strategies to get around the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. But really, my question is, do they get the job done? Or what do they give us, really? And that's my loose theme for this talk. So you'll see it is a little bit of a loose theme. Okay. So, right. So Ephraim talked about weak measurement, and one of the sort of frameworks that weak measurement was introduced in was this model of measurement by von Neumann. So von Neumann introduced this model of measurement to sort of look at how could measurement be described within quantum mechanics? Do we see collapse within quantum mechanics itself if we model the measurement process? So he started off with this system that could be in a superposition and couples it to another quantum system. Here we have a pointer that's in a wave function. You could think of this as a gas gauge, and this is our fuel tank with our superposition of fuel levels. You turn on a spring, this is our interaction Hamiltonian, and it moves you into this entangled state. So you don't see measurement happen, you don't see collapse happen. So von Neumann failed in that respect. And that's one of the issues in quantum mechanics. But then you can ask, well, let's stop this chain of quantum interactions right at this level and just think about what happens if you measure this classically, like with our standard measurement approaches or conventional measurement. It'll collapse the pointer wave function to a particular position. And so in those cases, because they're entangled, your gas tank will also collapse to the corresponding fuel level. And then if you start off with the same wave function to start off with, you can then repeat it, and you might get a different result, and you collapse to a different state. What's not so obvious is that if you take a histogram of all these results after repeating over and over, the actual position along this dial will give you the expectation value of the operator you're measuring, so the Born rule. Okay, so that sort of gives us a background. So naive strategy number one, what if we tried to learn a bit about X and P? So in that slit example I gave you, we're trying to know X with certainty, with very high precision, and we know nothing about P. So what if we balance how much we learn about X and P? Well, this was actually an idea that was introduced a long time ago in 1964 by these two guys, Arthurs and Kelly, And they thought about this von Neumann model, and they said, what if we have our system and we have two dials, one that measures x, so this Hamiltonian is set up to measure x, and this one's set up to measure p, and we balance this interaction so we know equal amounts out of both. So this is a very interesting idea. Nothing particularly surprising happened in their analysis. The average position of x, if you repeated this over and over again, turned out to be what you'd expect if you just measured x by itself, and same with p. But if you follow the sort of chain of references through the years, what this ended up leading to was this idea, this first described by Leonard, of balanced A-port homodyne. And so that's where you send in terms of the electric field, you send in an electric field quantum state into a beam splitter, and then you make a measurement of p using balanced homodyne here, and measurement of x, so just by changing the phase of your local oscillator over here. So you're making two precise measurements here and here, but you split your state there. And it turns out that that actually projects you onto a coherent state. A coherent state has equal uncertainty in x and p. And so the overlap of your state with the coherent state basically gives you the result of the measurement. And Shapiro and Yuen also came up with similar ideas around the same time in terms of what they called heterodyne detection, which is pretty similar. So this naive strategy, which I don't do any experiments on, but I'll come back to if I have time at the end of the talk, actually gives you something meaningful, this way of sharing the uncertainty between the two measurements. Okay. So my first strategy is going to be based on weak measurements. So I'm going to, again, tell you a little bit about weak measurement, a little bit differently than Ephraim did. So I told you about what a standard measurement does. On a shot-by-shot basis, you collapse into a particular level of your state. Now we're going to turn down the coupling of the spring, or the strength of the spring. And so we have to recalibrate our dial. So it's going to move our pointer by a much smaller distance. But our pointer stays in a wave function. So I'm going to zoom in here. And you can see now that even before starting the experiment, every possible result could occur. Even without turning on this coupling, this pointer could collapse into any of these markings. Right, so what's the advantage of this? Well, or what do we get? Well, one thing that's kind of interesting is if you just do this, what you find is that if you then measure the pointer, if you turn on this interaction Hamiltonian and then measure the pointer, and you do it over and over again for an identical ensemble of initial states, that you find a histogram that follows the pointer distribution, and the peak of the histogram again points to the Born rule. So it's, as Ephraim said, it sort of gives you what you'd expect from a normal measurement. But because this coupling is weak, you don't get very much entanglement between your pointer and your system. Or another way of saying that is that your system stays to a good approximation in a superposition. So we can find out more information about it afterwards. So we can do a strong measurement of some other thing, like the gas temperature, and find and then select those cases where the temperature is a certain value. So big B is equal to small b. And in that case, the pointer moves by a different amount, this weak value. And this is the formula for the weak value. And Ephraim said that, as Ephraim said, this thing can be complex, and it can be outside the range of eigenvalues. So what does the complex nature of this mean? It means that the real part of this is equal to the shift along the dial. An imaginary part of it is actually equal to a momentum kick that the pointer gets. So they both, the real and imaginary part, have very physical manifestations. OK, so I'm going to give you an example. This is the first actual weak measurement experiment. So you start off. So one of the things that's a little confusing about doing this with photons is that in my description with the von Neumann model, we have this separate system that we interact with our quantum system that we want to measure. Well, photons don't interact with other systems very well. So instead, we use two internal degrees of freedom, or 2 degrees of freedom of the photon, one that we call the quantum state and the other one that we call the pointer. So here, the pointer is going to be the transverse spatial degree of freedom. Our state is this is the polarization, and we set it with a polarizer. You go through a calcite crystal, and now you can see that H just goes through V, vertical polarization, gets displaced a little bit. And the fact that it's not a perfectly resolving experiment is due to the fact that these two pointer distributions are overlapped to a good degree. If this displacement was much larger than this width, then we'd know on a shot-by-shot basis whether the photon was H or V. So how does this weak value appear? Well, if we post-select on something, say something that's almost orthogonal, Then these two pointer distributions get flipped, and their amplitudes get changed by a little bit, by delta, where delta is how close our final polarization state is to orthogonal. And those two things, if you look at the math, interfere, and they give you a rigidly shifted pointer distribution. So it has the same shape as that, but its peak is amplified. So it gets shifted by 1 over delta. So this can be used to amplify small effects, perhaps. And then I just want to quickly tell you how the same thing occurs, the same interference leads to a momentum shift. So we have a circular polarizer afterwards. So now the two momentum distributions have different phases. And one's higher on one side, and the other one's higher on the other side. So you expect the phase to go from one thing to another on the other side. So to first order, you have a linear phase gradient in this plane. And so in the momentum plane, you're going to get a momentum shift, right? Because it's the Fourier transform of the position plane. So that's how the shift in the momentum of the pointer occurs. It's, again, through this interference effect. OK. So this is naive strategy two, is we're going to weakly, gently measure the position. Since a strong measurement of it is giving us a disturbance of the momentum, we're going to weakly measure it. And we're going to weakly measure this projector. We're going to start off with an initial state. And then we're going to make a strong measurement of P afterwards and take only that subensemble of systems, of initial systems that had results small p. So we start off with our weak value formula. We sub in these projectors. And what you see here is that you get the wave function over here. This is the wave function in position basis. This is e to the I px. This is the Fourier transform of the wave function, or in the momentum distribution amplitude. And if you take, for instance, p equals 0, then you get a constant here, a constant there, and you get the wave function here. So this is an experiment that we did that showed that if you weakly measure the position followed by momentum, you get the wave function, something proportional to the wave function. So that was done in 2011, so it's kind of old news now. But that was our naive strategy number one. So how did we actually do the experiment? Well, we start off with polarized photons. So the wave function that we're going to try and measure is the transverse spatial wave function of the photon. So we're switching the roles from that weak value measurement experiment I told you about with the calcite crystal. In that one, the pointer was the transverse degree of freedom, and the quantum system was the polarization. Here, the polarization will be our pointer, so it's on a circular dial. And we're going to be measuring the transverse wave function. So we make a measurement of x by putting in a wave plate at a particular position. If it rotates the polarization by 90 degrees, then it's a strong measurement. If it rotates it by a small amount, then it's a weak measurement. And then we go into the Fourier space, the momentum space, by taking a lens. We put a slit. We only take those photons with p equals 0. And then we look at how much the pointer got shifted along the dial and how much its momentum got shifted. So that's equivalent to looking at the difference between left-hand circular and right-hand circular. And that gives you the imaginary part of the wave function. And then the difference between 45 and minus 45 gives you the real part of the wave function. So we call this a direct measurement of the wave function. And hopefully I'll be able to illustrate why that's true, why we called it that. So this is what the sort of setup looked like, or at least a part of it. We had a fiber back here. We set its polarization with this motor with a polarizer in it. And then we have this quartz sliver, this lens to collimate the light. And what we did is we scanned that quartz sliver, this little sliver, across the wave function. And then we looked at these two different signals. And those two different signals, one of them should give you the real part of the wave function, the other one should give you the imaginary part. And indeed, that's what we saw. And if you took the absolute square of that, it exactly agreed with what you would see. The absolute square of the real and imaginary part should give you the probability. And so that's the red dots here. And when we scanned a detector across here, which measures the probability directly, that's that black line, they agreed exactly. OK, so that we had other measurements that kind of illustrated that this technique was working, but I don't have time to really go into them now. Since this is a quantum foundations workshop, more interested in what does this really tell us and why did we call it direct? And when we called it direct, we were really trying to contrast it with known ways to determine the quantum state, in particular quantum state tomography. So we called it direct because it's local. We can decide to measure the wave function at a particular position and not at others, whereas quantum state tomography, you have to do this global reconstruction. There's no complicated mathematical reconstruction like there is in state tomography. So in this case, we just have these two different signals. Again, sort of saying the same thing in a different way, the value of the wave function just appears directly on our apparatus. And then it's simple to sort of explain. We gently measure X and then strongly measure P. Whereas in state tomography, you have to do these measurements in all these different bases. It's basically an inversion of the Born rule. It's a little bit more difficult to explain. So for those reasons, we called it direct. And I still don't really have a great insight in, like, I don't have a good way of thinking about what this tells us about quantum mechanics, but perhaps one direction to follow is to sort of look back at history and say, what other abstract concepts did people have trouble getting their mind around, their head around? And one of those is electric and magnetic fields. So people didn't really know what these things were when they showed up in the theories. They weren't sure if they're real things or not. And really the existence of or invention of the concept of test particles sort of cemented this view that magnetic and electric fields were actually physical things. If you use metal iron filings, they follow the magnetic field lines. If you use grass seeds, they follow the electric field lines. And mathematically, the concept here is that you let the mass and the charge to go to zero. In our case, we let the strength of the measurement go to zero. And it's sort of probing this wave function. And finally, the nice thing about this direct procedure is that it gives a very simple operational definition of what the wave function is. So if you go back to textbooks, you'll see that most textbooks don't actually define what the wave function is. Even if they claim to at the beginning of the chapter, by the time you get to the end of the chapter, you realize they never did actually define it. And an operational definition just means in terms of a set of operations, procedures in the lab. So in this case, it would mean the wave function is the average result of a weak measurement of a variable followed by the strong measurement of the complementary variable. So it's a fairly succinct definition. Okay, one of the criticisms of that experiment when it came out, and I still hear this a lot to this day, is that we would have seen the same, we did that experiment with single photons, but we would have seen the same results if we had done it with classical light, a classical light source, so a laser or something, an attenuated laser. And because of that, they think that that technique, this idea of weakly measuring one variable and then strongly measuring a complementary variable, is only applicable to photons that are described by Maxwell's equations, so not quantum particles. But in fact, there's this experiment that I did while I was a graduate student in Ephraim's group. And I didn't realize this at the time, and I don't think Ephraim did either, but what we were actually doing in that experiment was weakly measuring the entangled state that we had in that system. So in this is actually a probe of what other people than myself called Hardy's paradox. So that's Hardy over there. And it's two overlapping Mach-Zehnder interferometers. The actual idea behind it is not so important here. The point is that you end up with this interesting entangled state here in terms of two photons, one in each interferometer, which paths are they in? This is the state here, inner, outer path. And so what we did is we were trying to figure out which paths were does weak measurement tell you the particles are in. So we were doing measurements where we'd post-select on getting a click here. And what you can see is that because you're post-selecting after a beam splitter, you're actually looking at a coherent and even superposition of these two paths. You're actually looking at which path and then sort of wave-like behavior. So these are actually two complementary variables, detecting after the beam splitter and detecting before the beam splitter. So doing those two measurements jointly is actually going to be giving us a state. And so we did that, and we didn't really know this at the time. So we did things like we measured this projector in the cases where we got a click at D plus and D minus. And the weak value of these projectors actually give you the amplitudes of each of these terms. And this is what we got. So we didn't get a very great result, but it's close to what you expect. In particular, you expect there to be a minus here. We got almost minus one. This is supposed to be zero. We got 0.23, 243. That's because our visibility in the system wasn't so good. So the point is that the idea actually does apply to quantum systems. Another criticism of that work was that it only applies to pure states, to wave functions. Actually, this is from Mike Raymer, the first person to do quantum state tomography, and a friend of mine. But we knew even before we published that paper that that wasn't really a restriction. For sure, if you're only post-selecting on p equals zero, you can't discern between a mixed state and a pure state. You have to assume you're starting off with a pure state if you're going to be measuring the wave function. But what if you instead take all the final p and you look at the difference, those two different signals, the difference between 45 and minus 45 and right hand and left hand circular at each of these pixels, right? Now this is starting to look a little bit less like a weak value measurement, but rather just a joint measurement, because now we're taking all p. So what does this give us? Well, I figured it out very quickly what this gave us, and it ended up giving us this 2D, because you're scanning x and you have p, so you have two dimensions now, this 2D complex distribution, and I had no idea what it was. It took me a long time of digging through the literature to find out that Dirac had actually proposed it. He didn't know about the Wigner function. I didn't know about the Q function. I'm not sure the Q function was invented at that time. So he proposed it as a quasi-probability distribution to describe operators in quantum mechanics. So this is something that has some history. And so I called it the Dirac distribution. He didn't call it that. And it turns out that if you do this joint measurement, in fact, any joint measurement using weak measurements, where you do one strong and one weak and then one strong, or even 2 weeks, you get this much simpler formula for the joint result. So here we have the trace, and then you have your one operator, the other operator, and the density matrix. So what's kind of fascinating to me is that the weak value looks very strange. Like it looks a little bit like the expectation value, but it's also kind of weird. It can get big. Whereas if you look at just doing a joint measurement and not post-selecting on one particular result, the average result is exactly the Born rule. It's just now we can put things in it that are not Hermitian operators, because this p times x is not a Hermitian operator. And that's because we can measure these complex numbers. They're just the shifts of the momentum and position parts of the pointer. So I kind of like thinking about this as weak measurement now, not the weak value, because it's a nicer formula, basically. Fits more with what we typically think of as the measurement formula in quantum mechanics. And that gives, so that thing gives us the Dirac distribution. Right, so what is this Dirac distribution? Well, I found out even later that this Dirac distribution is closely linked to distributions you've probably all heard about, or a lot of you have heard about, the P distribution, the Q distribution, the Wigner function. The way I like thinking about all of these quasi-probability distributions now is just that they're ways of translating a measurement of a point in phase space to quantum mechanics. So a point in phase space, so if we want to measure a 2D probability distribution in phase space, we want to say, for instance, measure how many particles or how often we have a particle at a particular point in phase space, and then scan that around, raster it around. How do we translate that into quantum mechanics? Well, you have to choose an operator ordering. And the different orderings of how you choose that to translate that 2D Dirac delta function give you the different quasi-probability distributions, it turns out. So the Q function is due to the normal ordering, the Wigner function is called the symmetric ordering, and the P function is due to the antinormal ordering. So the way you see this in textbooks is they describe it in terms of characteristic functions. Well, most people in physics don't actually know what a characteristic function is. Like, you tend to learn about that when you get deep into probability theory. So I think this is actually a better way to think about it, because it's really just how do you measure a point in phase space? How do you translate that to quantum mechanics? You have to choose an ordering. Those different orderings give you the different quasi-probability distributions. So this is where the Dirac distribution comes in, because there's two other orderings, standard and anti-standard. Instead of doing it in terms of A and A dagger, you can do it in terms of X and P. And those two orderings translate into the Dirac distribution. And so, so just again, we get this Dirac distribution coming out of this. So you can kind of think of it as there being a constellation of quasi-probability distributions with the Wigner function at the center. So if you think about orderings in terms of A and A dagger, then you get P if you get A dagger before A, Q if you get A dagger after A, symmetric in terms of the raising and lowering operators, at least when you have two operators, looks like that, And in terms of X and P, it has the same form. So the symmetric ordering for X and P and A and A dagger actually have the same form. And then if you look in terms, if you look at the quasi-probability distributions for X and P in their orderings, then you get the Dirac distribution and then the complex conjugate of the Dirac distribution. So these things fit. This naive strategy gives us the Dirac distribution, and they actually fit well within our knowledge, our framework of quasi-probability distributions. Until we had measured that, I haven't shown you the measurements yet. We measured that, and until that point, nobody had actually measured this thing. So this is a quasi-probability distribution that was kind of just floating out there. Dirac had proposed it, but nobody had actually measured it. And we knew how to measure it, but we didn't know what the thing we were measuring was until we put the two together. So here we're post-selecting on all, well, not even post-selecting anymore. This is the final momenta, so the final pixel at the camera. And this is us looking at the different signals as you scan the position across. So I'm just plotting the real part here of the Dirac distribution. So there's an imaginary matrix that goes like that as well. And one thing we wanted to show is that this can actually let you characterize mixed states as well. And so the way we did that is we put a glass piece across half our beam and we vibrated it. So we made it the two halves of our spatial wave function incoherent with each other. And you see a little bit of a change in terms of the Dirac distribution. The Dirac distribution, just like all quasi-probability distributions, is related to the density matrix by a Fourier transform in some phase that I'm not going to talk about. And so in the case where we don't vibrate the glass plate, we get this in terms of the position density matrix for the photon. And when we do vibrate it, we get this. And when all of our off diagonals disappear between the two halves of the beam. Is that a beep for me?
I don't think so.
Okay. right. As far as I know, this is the first time people actually measured this for spatial distributions. Nobody had actually measured mixed states or the density matrix for mixed states or even the quasi-probability distributions for spatial distributions for mixed states. So this kind of enabled that. What time is it? Do I have time to do this? I have half an hour. No, for 15 minutes? I got 15 minutes. Okay. Let me just think about what I have to say. I'll just say something really quickly. Another cool thing about the Dirac distribution, and this is something that Holger Hoffman showed, was that you can propagate it just using Bayes' law. So in some ways, it behaves much more like a standard probability than the Wigner function does. I won't get into the details. We actually did it just by moving our camera. So we let our state propagate a little bit, and then we used Bayes' law to propagate it, and we had got this experimental results for our Dirac distribution as we moved our camera out. And then we got these theoretical predictions, and you can see they're fairly close. Okay, so this is naive strategy number three. I've told you how to make a weak measurement of X, and I've told you how to make a strong measurement of P. But now that we have this idea of weakly measuring something, why don't we weakly measure P afterwards and then weakly measure something else after that and just keep going and see what we get? What if we sequence between these measurements? What would that give? So in particular, I'm going to talk about this sequence. What if we measure X, and more specifically a projector of X, then a projector of P, and then a projector of X? These could all be weak. It turns out that these two could be weak and this one could be strong. It doesn't really make a difference. The answer is, for what you get for this naive strategy, is the density matrix. And so this is a way of directly measuring any particular element of the density matrix. So you leave this guy fixed. You can project onto any P you want, but it just has to be fixed over your measurement. And then you vary this to go up one axis of your density matrix. Then you vary that projector to go across the other one, and you dial in whichever element you want. We published the idea for this in 2012, and then just a couple weeks ago, we published it. How did we actually do these weak measurements? So this goes right back to that Ritchie and Hewlett very first weak measurement experiment. We're using calcite crystals. So in that experiment, they only displace along one direction, but we have another internal degree of freedom of the photon that we can use, which is the other direction. So we put two calcite crystals in, one that displaces upwards and one that displaces sideways. And then the first one is going to measure not X and P. We're not going to do X and P, we're going to do polarization. So one's going to measure H or V, and then the next one's going to measure D. And then we'll do a strong measurement, because you don't have to do three weak measurements in a row, that'll measure in the HV basis. And basically, this, however you set this polarizer and this first weak measurement will dial in whichever element of your density matrix that you want to measure. So this is what the actual experiment looked like. This time we actually did it with the laser beam because there really is no difference with doing it with a single photon. We prepare our states just in a standard way with a polarizing beam splitter and some wave plates. We also are able to make mixed states by spinning a wave plate. We have our calcite crystal, a wave plate to move us into the diagonal basis, and then another calcite crystal, and then a wave plate and a polarizing beam splitter to make a projection onto H or V. How do we read off these pointers? We now have a pointer that's reading off our first measurement and our second measurement, and they're the different spatial degrees of freedom of our photon. So one is the X direction of our photon, transverse direction, the other one's the Y direction. Well, we need to measure this thing. This is actually something that Kevin and I showed way back in 2005, and it's still a little bit of a mystery to me, because it turns out that the weak value that we all, that we know about from Ephraim and my talk, is actually equal to the expectation value of the lowering operator on your pointer. Why? I don't know. I don't know why the lowering operator is related to weak measurement. That's a mystery to me. But it gives you a way of doing joint weak measurements. Usually, if you wanted to do a joint measurement, you'd have to couple two systems together. Here, instead, we look at our two pointers and we look at correlations between them. And this is the correlation that we want to measure. We want to measure the lowering operator in the X degree of freedom times the lowering operator in the Y degree of freedom times the projector of the original quantum system on polarization J. So when I say the lowering operator, I just mean A is proportional to X plus IP, basically, up to some constants. So that tells you the expectation values that you need to evaluate on your pointers. So you need to measure correlations between X and X, the X direction, the Y direction, the momentum in the Y direction, and the X direction. You have to do these different correlations.
Sorry, Jeff, just yeah. Look at row of I, J. I and J are labeling yellow.
The first calcite crystal is measuring, is a weak measurement to measure the projector of I, right? So polarization along I. And it's coupling to the X degree of freedom. So to read off that measurement, we have to look at the pointer, and we have to evaluate the expectation value of the lowering operator on the X degree of freedom of the pointer. So this, we've set this up already to measure I, and then we just want to read it off. So this is actually, there's sort of an implicit that we've set this pointer up to be coupled to I. And then this last one is we're evaluating on, directly on the system. So it's, yeah, so that's the formula. And we did it. And the first thing we did is we just went around different paths in the block sphere and showed that we could measure each element of the density matrix as we traveled around those paths. So we went around one. And there's four elements to the density matrix, and so we just showed that we could get all four. I say there's four because one is eliminated by normalization, but actually we don't need to put any normalization into our system. It just pops out. So it actually tells us these elements should already be normalized by our measurement procedure. And then we went around the green path here, and again, our measurements of the four density matrix elements seem to agree well. And then we wanted to show that it works for mixed states because we're talking about density matrices. And so we went up this axis here. So we became more pure as we go along this axis. And so this is some parameter that moves us along this yellow curve here. And you can see our density matrices get bigger and bigger off diagonal. So they're getting more pure. And you can plot the purity measured, which is the square points compared to what we theoretically expect for the states. And you can also plot the trace distance between the measured density matrices and the expected ones. And it's less than 5% for all the different density matrices. So it works pretty well. Okay, so I only have, how much time? Yep. 10 minutes or so? Yeah?
Well, till
20 after? Oh, I thought you said 15 after, okay. Okay, this is my last strategy. I'm sure I'm overwhelming you with information, but this one is, one I find particularly perplexing because it reveals links between these different strategies. So this is another naive strategy in that if you told somebody who didn't know anything about quantum mechanics that you can't measure X and then P on the same system because X disturbs P, they might say, well, just copy the state of your particle and then measure X on one and then P on the other copy. They can't disturb each other anymore because they're separate. You can take them far apart if you want to. So I'm sure everyone in this room knows that you can't copy quantum particles. There's the known cloning theorem, right? But we can ask, what is the closest strategy that quantum physics allows us to do to this? And there's something, there's a long line of research into what is the best cloning that we can do in quantum mechanics. And that's called optimal symmetric universal cloning. So we'd like to make perfect clones. Instead, we're going to make the best clones allowed by quantum mechanics. And this kind of unruly name, optimal symmetric universal, I'll tell you what that means. Optimal just means that the fidelity of each clone with the initial state is as high as possible, allowed by quantum mechanics. The clones have to have the same fidelity, so that's a constraint. It's symmetric, and it's universal, so they have the same fidelity for any input state. So there's no, obviously, if you send in a known set of states, you can do much better at cloning. For instance, if you set in H and V, you can clone them perfectly. There's no possibility of D. Okay, so let's go a little bit into the theory of cloning, of this optimal cloning, because it's quite nice. Basically, the optimal clone state is just the projection of your input density matrix and a completely mixed state, I, onto the symmetric subspace of those two particles. That's it. That's what gives you the optimal clones. That gives you the optimal clone state, up to some normalization. Okay, and you can see this as just with the result of one of these two clones is just that on the block sphere, the block vector, just or Poincaré vector, Stokes vector, just shrinks, and shrinks by a factor of 2/3. So that's what it does. That's general cloning. And you can see there's this relation to this symmetric projector. So there's a relationship between cloning and symmetry. How do you actually do cloning? Well, it was shown by a variety of people and implemented by Baumeister in 2004 that the way you can do optimal cloning is just use a beam splitter. So you take a beam splitter and you send in a completely mixed state, say of polarization, if you're doing it in the polarization space, into one input port. You send in the state that you want to clone into the other input port. In the case where they bunch together, you have cloning. You have optimal cloning. So in the case where they exit the same port of the beam splitter, you have perfect cloning, or optimal cloning. So the way to think about why this works is to realize that a mixed state is half the time in this state and half the time in the orthogonal state. So half of the time, you're sending in the same state and you get something called Hongel-Mandel interference, and the two photons always leave together and they're perfect clones because they were the same state. The other half of the time, they're in orthogonal states. And in that case, they can still leave the same port sometimes together. There's no interference effect, so they just act like billiard balls. There's just a probability that they'll leave together, and that's your contamination. That's what makes it not perfect cloning. Okay, quantum optically, what is happening here? Well, if you've studied quantum optics, you know that if you send in two states into a beam splitter, and you look at the cases where they separate, you're actually projecting onto the singlet state, the anti-symmetric space. The cases where they're in the symmetric space, they bunch together. And that's what a beam splitter does. It actually turns your symmetry operator into a field parity operator. And the field parity operator is related to the number of photons. So if you're odd, you have an odd number of photons, and if you're even, you have an even number of photons. That's one way of thinking about what a beam splitter does. Right. Okay, so now I come to how would we use this strategy, and what does it give us in quantum mechanics? So we're gonna do this cloning on a beam splitter. They both leave in the same direction when we have optimal cloning. Then we split them up, and we measure one observable on one and the complementary observable on the other. And you can ask, what does that give us? And that's what Holger Hoffman asked a few years ago, and this is what got me interested in this idea. And he showed that, in fact, this question has been asked a lot of times because it was one of the original motivations for cloning. It was like, does this let us make complementary measurements better? But they never really asked, they asked questions like, what is the uncertainty in X and what is the uncertainty in P? And how does X relate to the original X? They didn't actually ask just what is that joint probability distribution. And it turns out that the probability of getting small x on one and small p on the other, it's just a probability of x on the original state, p rho n, probability p on the original state, and then this thing. This is the real part of the Dirac distribution. Somehow, these two different strategies for making joint measurements, two very different strategies, there's no weak measurement in this, give you the Dirac distribution. But this is just the real part. What about the imaginary part? Well, it turns out the imaginary part is related to another symmetry of the system. So here we are projecting onto the symmetric state. Here we want to project onto this thing here. And this is actually the square root swap gate, which people might know from quantum computing. It's one of the gates you need for universal, or could use for universal quantum computing. And then if you do that, you project onto the swap gate, or that weird thing here. So this is a projector onto the anti-symmetric space. This is a projector onto symmetric space. And then you have this I between them. Then you get this thing, where the imaginary part shows up. And so together, the two things determine the Dirac distribution. So why is there this relationship between cloning and symmetry? Well, I think this is really a nice sort of story from quantum optics or quantum information. So I'm going to tell it to you. There's actually a naive way of cloning quantum particles. And that is you take two particles, you take your initial state that you want to clone, and then you take another particle that's in a completely mixed state, and then you just switch them randomly. So 50% of the time you switch them. And then that actually does pretty well in terms of the fidelity of what comes out. And so that's one way of saying is we're swapping them. So that's sort of the naive optimal strategy that you would have without quantum mechanics. You're just randomly 50% of the time you swap them, 50% of the time you don't. So how can you think of the symmetric projector in terms of that swap operation? Well, it turns out you can write the symmetric projector in terms of this swap, this you think of as just changing the position of the identical particles, as a superposition of doing nothing, the identity operator, and swapping the two particles. So I think this is really cool. Optimal cloning is like the coherent way of doing this process of switching the particles. So before, we were probabilistically either switching them or not. And now, by projecting onto symmetric space, we're coherently switching them or not. And that actually does a little bit better than the incoherent way of doing it. And it also gives us a way of defining these new projectors, these square root swaps. Because now that we see that, we see there's this phase between these two things that we can play with. We can set it to be I, and then we get these new quasi-projectors. And if you project onto these projectors, you can see you can get rid of those other terms, and you get exactly the real and imaginary parts of the Dirac distribution. OK, so I should say, and that's exactly what we're doing here. So we have this case where they split up. So this is when they split up, you're getting the and you're projecting onto the anti-symmetric space. When they stay together, you're projecting onto the symmetric space. And then we coherently recombine those two possibilities at a beam splitter. This is actually an idea by Furasik. So he was the first to implement the square root swap gate. So we're just really copying his idea here and then adding on these measurements, these joint measurements at the end. So that's how you implement this coherent superposition of these two operators. Right, so what did we actually do in the experiment? I should say we're not actually done this experiment. So this is work in progress. We're almost done. We just have to solve a little technical problem. So I'm expecting, well, I shouldn't say when I'm expecting because it's never right. So we start off with our two photons from down conversion. We split them up, send them into fibers, send them to a Sagnac. That's that Mach sender that I showed you on the other page. Except it's a weird Sagnac. It's a displaced Sagnac where the two counterpropagating directions are slightly offset from each other. That's because we want to address one direction at a time. And also, one of the mirrors in the Sagnac is a beam splitter. I won't go into all the details. So we do these joint measurements now, not of X and P, but of polarization. And so far, we've done it for H and V, and it seems to work properly. It doesn't work for D and right-hand circular. And it's basically because right now we have some additional birefringent phases in our experiment that we're trying to nail down. But it looks like, indeed, this does give you the Dirac distribution, this completely different strategy. So that brings me to the end of the talk. So I told you about that these naive strategies for doing joint measurements of complementary variables actually give you interesting things. In the Arthurs and Kelly scheme, it gives you the Q function. In my idea of gently measuring X and then strongly measuring P, it gives you the wave function. If you don't post-select on only one value of P, it gives you the Dirac distribution, which is actually related to all the other quasi-probability distributions. And then if you cycle between them, you can actually get any element of the density matrix you want. And this is something I still don't understand. Like, why I was drawn to this paper by Holger Hoffman, because I couldn't understand why cloning was related to weak measurement. They both appear to be related to symmetries in space, in quantum physics. And finally, I already told you how direct measurement gives quantum states an operational meaning in terms of procedures in the laboratory. One more thing I forgot to tell you guys is there's another connection between cloning and these joint measurements. So it turns out that the 8-port homodyne system that we've used to measure the Q function that Leonard proposed is actually pretty much identical to the system that we would use to clone a continuous variable state. So in fact, what we're doing to that in that system is we're cloning a continuous variable state, so something that's continuous in an electric field, and then we're making joint measurements of X and P. In the continuous case, it gives us the Q function. In the discrete case, it gives us the Dirac distribution. So there's this fundamental difference between the continuous and discrete case that I find kind of interesting. And that was the last thing I wanted to say. Thanks.
Questions?
So in the first part of your talk, concerning measuring the wave function of the photon,
yeah.
Can you just clarify what you mean by the wave function of the photon? So usually I think, you know, massive particles have wave functions, photons don't have wave functions, so I would just...
Okay. So I wish I had left the slide in, right? Because I often get this question. So, I mean, my you're right. There is no mass in the Schrodinger equation. So the thing that appears in the Schrodinger equation we can't really write down for the photon. But the Schrodinger equation is a non-relativistic equation, and the photon is naturally relativistic. So we wouldn't expect that. So maybe the better thing to compare it to is the relativistic, the Dirac equation. So if you look at that case, you also have problems writing down a wave function for your particle. There are problems with normalization, it becomes non-local, and exactly those problems also are the same problems that occur for the photon. So in the same sense that we can write down a wave function for an electron, we can write down a wave function for a photon. It's just in the relativistic limit, they both break down. So what is the non-relativistic limit for a photon? It sounds ridiculous to even say it. The case, it's kind of a strange situation, because we often write down wave functions for photons in quantum optics. And you kind of ask, well, how we've been getting away with this for so many years when technically there is none. And the answer is that we're always in the paraxial slowly varying envelope approximation. And in that approximation, the main problem with writing down a wave function for a photon is that the normalization doesn't work. Like, if you normalize over all space to give you a probability of one, that doesn't work. But in that approximation, it does work. So, and the inner products work properly to as good as the approximation is. So because most of our experiments are in that approximation, then we can treat it as having a wave function, just like the electron has a wave function in the non-relativistic limit.
So if you see that approximation, if you were to force that approximation to break down, mm-hmm. How would it manifest itself in your measurement of the wave function?
My measurement of the wave function, first of all, you wouldn't even really know what to write down for an X measurement. Like, exactly how you'd even do the experiment would change. Like, I have lots of I rely on that approximation in many ways. So for instance, a lens taking a Fourier transform relies on that approximation. It's actually a pretty unexplored area in quantum optics. What happens in quantum optics when you're far outside the paraxial approximation? I know John Sipe is working on it a bit, Mike Raymer is also working on it a little bit. I'd like to work on it, but I don't have any great experimental ideas. One of the issues with trying to look for something interesting in quantum optics where that approximation breaks down is that it's all in Maxwell's equations, right? And we understand Maxwell's equations really well. Like the breakdown of the paraxial limit shows up in Maxwell's equations, and people who understand Maxwell's equations really well already can point to the places where that happens. And so you have to come up with something that would surprise them as well, right? So it has to be something naturally quantum optical.
What regime, though? What would you have to do to get outside this graph?
I think, in terms of an experiment, the easiest thing is just focus really tightly. So in Maxwell's equations, one thing that you can see is that the intense, like one place where you can see this effect of the paraxial approximation breaking down and even the normalization not working, is if you focus really tightly a beam of light, then the intensity distribution does not follow the electric field or magnetic field distribution. So if you plot the strength of the electric field, you can get electric fields that are strong outside where you have energy, for instance, or outside where you have a magnetic field. And so that's well known in classical optics. So you have to show something more. But that's essentially the idea, is that that's the normalization issue. It's like you don't even know what to normalize by. Do you normalize by the probability? Do you normalize by the electric field?
Other questions?
Yep. So with that same scheme where you're doing the direct measurement of the wave function, so I have two questions. One is conceptual and one is technical. Do you always get values that are inside the range of eigenvalues because you're mapping things directly to probabilities?
That's a good question. We're not post-selecting on something that's orthogonal to our initial state, so. I think we do, but you don't always have to. Like you tend to, but you don't always have to. Yeah, you can get spikes in your wave function.
How do you get back to the wave function in that case? Because
let me think about this for a second. So okay, so I think if okay, so what can happen in our experiment? Like how can it go wrong, for instance? Well, one way it could go wrong is if you post-select on a momentum where there just are no photons. Like if you start off with a state that doesn't have a probability to have a particular momentum and you post-select on it, you'll just end up with no photons. And what happens in that regime is that the weak you can't make a weak measurement because the weak measurement depends on that post-selection probability. So then you'll just get the wrong results. But what you would do experimentally is you'd see that right away. I have no light. I'm going to move my post-selection. It doesn't really matter what I set it to. I'll just set it to something finite. And then it'll work out. You won't get those large eigenvalues. So basically, you just need to make sure your post-selection probability is somewhat big. Not vanishing.
But is there an eigenvalue spectrum? You're measuring.
It's 0 and 1 because you're measuring a projector. The eigenvalue spectrum.
The weak value has to be the wave, the amplitude at that point.
I guess if it goes negative, you're outside the eigenvalue spectrum, right? Because the eigenvalue is 0 and 1. Yeah.
If you get 1.5,
right,
and you're mapping it to an amplitude, that's.
It's still okay because it's a. It's a probability density distribution, right? So it's the integral that is actually a probability.
Wait a second. I thought you were doing a weak measurement of position.
Yeah, you're making a weak measurement of a projector position. Yeah.
So it's bounded.
It's bounded by 0 and 1. Yeah.
My other question is more conceptual. So when you get the real part of the wave function, I understand how that's like the name you. Approach, but when you get the imaginary part, I don't see how you could say it's very naive. Like, why would I? If I didn't know any quantum mechanics, why would I expect
to even look there? You mean?
Why would you
even look there, right?
And why would I say, okay, oh, I saw a change in momentum. I'm going to call that the imaginary part.
No, I don't think there is a good way to explain that naively. It's more the naive part was just like trying to measure gently, trying to measure gently so you don't disturb momentum, because that's what prevents you from naively measuring the state of the particle. So all of these started off as sort of naive motivations, and just like the cloning, you have to translate, I translated them into their quantum equivalents that were actually possible in physics. So yeah, at that point it stops being naive, for sure.
Any more questions? Okay, let's thank Jeff again.